Listen now.
Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. On this show, I interview some of the best thought leaders and activists about solutions to the most important issues of our time. Today, we'll talk about what we can do to fix our broken democracy. We see the problems with our democracy, the influence of big money on politics, leading to a government that works well for wealthy donors but not the rest of us, the suppression of voters, knocking legitimate voters off the rolls, as happened in Georgia and elsewhere last year, gerrymandering, the drawing of district lines so the politicians choose the voters rather than the voters choosing the politicians. Our guest today understands all these problems and just published a book outlining solutions for all these challenges and more. Joshua A. Douglas is the author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. The book shows how we can reform our democracy by telling the stories of people who are doing it successfully across the country. He is a professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law, where he focuses on the constitutional right to vote and election administration. Joshua A. Douglas, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be on.
I'm excited to hear this because a lot of people are so depressed about what's happening in our democracy and our voting and all that, and you have a marvelous book. Tell us, why did you decide to write this new book, Vote for Us?
Yeah, thank you. You're right. There's a lot of doom and gloom out there. Most people I talk to who talk about the right to vote and what they've heard feel like voter suppression is on the rise, that it's becoming harder to participate in our democracy, that the system is, well, I guess I'll use that dreaded R word, rigged on all sides, and people are fed up, and yet they don't really know what to do about it. And in my studies as an election law professor, I learned about all of these great positive voting rights reforms, ways that people were making it easier to vote, more inclusive, more democratic, more convenient, and I wanted to tell those stories.
Yeah, fantastic, and you tell them so beautifully. So let's get right to it. Like, in your book, what is your favorite story of a citizen working for a solution?
I think my favorite is the story I start the book with, which comes from my state of Kentucky. But I had it at the beginning of the book because I think it's a pretty surprising story. Mm-hmm. This deals with felon disenfranchisement. Now, Kentucky is one of the worst states in the country for felon disenfranchisement. It disenfranchises felons for life. And, you know, Kentucky's generally thought of as a deep red state politically. But the legislature had considered for years an expungement bill to allow at least some low-level felons to get an expungement of their records. And it had never passed, and never really gotten any traction. And then a couple years ago, a guy named West Powell went to testify before the Kentucky Senate Judiciary Committee. And he told his story. He said, you know, I was 18 a while ago, and I made a dumb mistake. I stole a car radio from an auto salvage yard. He was caught and convicted, ended up spending about 11 months in jail, but then got out and said, you know, I've got to clean up my life. What am I doing? This is not who I am or want to be. so he tried to get a job, actually had a hard time because of his felony conviction, so he opened up his own computer repair shop. He met a woman and got married. He had five kids. He says it was four girls and one boy, and he kind of always wanted a boy, but the girls came first, so what are you going to do? And he said, yet I still couldn't feel like I was part of my society. I was still cut out because of my felony conviction. And he spoke for about 4 minutes. And in the hearing room that day was a Republican senator named Whitney Westerfield, who is a pro-law enforcement conservative who said he didn't think anything would change his mind. He opposed expungement. He said, they're felons. That's who they are. And he heard Wes Powell speak. And something clicked for him right then and there, and he changed his mind on the spot. He said, you know, this is exactly what our criminal justice system is supposed to do. You make a mistake 25 years ago, you don't do it again, you clean up your life. What more could you do? And he rallied his fellow Republicans to champion this bill on a bipartisan basis for felony expungement, and it passed. And my favorite part of the story is the kicker. Wes Powell did get an expungement of his record, and he became a voter. He got his right to vote back, and he hasn't missed an election since.
That's fantastic. Well, good for him. It's a really inspiring story, and I love that it's happening in your state there of Kentucky. And now we've got this whole issue of felon reenfranchisement is come back on the agenda in a big way. I'm kind of curious, where does this whole thing come from? Like when you commit a felony, you lose your right to vote. Has that always been true, or when did that come into practice?
It really started in the post-Reconstruction years, after the Civil War, when states, largely started by Southern states, were seeking ways to disenfranchise newly freed slaves and African Americans. I mean, felon disenfranchisement has a history of racial discrimination. And there's a whole slew of voting practices that were passed, including literacy tests and poll taxes and other kinds of tests like, can you tell me how many bubbles there are in a bar of soap, or you can't be registered, but of course only asked of the African Americans. And felon disenfranchisement is part and parcel of those kinds of packages. So it has a racist history, and it really has still a racist legacy given the numbers of people who are disenfranchised because of a felony, largely disproportionately racial minorities.
Yeah, and the story you tell about Wes Powell in Kentucky is a story that's really come in a big way in Florida this past year, where a former homeless man really kind of got organized and ran a whole campaign on the ballot to re-enfranchise what he calls returning citizens, and got, I think it's 1.3 million more people in Florida now are able to vote. And it was, he did a campaign where he spoke about forgiveness and about reconciliation. And he ended up getting support from the left and the right, from Democrats and Republicans, people wanting to give those who had kind of gotten off the right track, give them a chance to return and to have their voice and vote as a citizen. So I think that's such an inspiring story, but where are they? I know it's different in different states. We got some states allow people even to vote from prison. Tell us a little bit about where you are disenfranchised and where you could still vote despite
the
felony.
Yeah, let me just say before I get to that I had a chance to speak with Desmond Mead after the book was published, the individual you talked about in Florida. Mm-hmm. And he is one of the warmest and interesting people I've met. I got to give him a book because I profile him in the book as well. And, you know, the message here really is, what if we replicate the Wes Powell story and the Desmond Mead story all over the country and promote positive voting rights reforms that make our system so much more inclusive? And, you know, it's just so inspiring. Now, to your direct question on where we are around the states, as you noted, two states allow prisoners to vote from prison, Maine and Vermont. I don't think anyone thinks democracy is broken in those places. And as you noted, this has become a little bit of a contentious debate point for the Democratic nominees for president right now. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have two states that disenfranchised felons for life, Kentucky and Iowa. It was four states. Florida and Virginia were on that list as well. You just mentioned how Florida voters just passed a state constitutional amendment to re-enfranchise about 1.4 million former felons, or returning citizens, as Desmond Meade refers to them. Virginia's governors have been signing executive orders to re-enfranchise felons in that state. So now we're down to two that essentially have the worst states for felon disenfranchisement, Kentucky and Iowa. The Iowa governor actually has expressed interest in repealing that law, and there is a movement in Kentucky not only for the expungement, which is just a very small part of it, but to actually make more radical changes. And, you know, I think this is gaining a lot of support all over the place.
Yeah, and you're right. This issue of the re-enfranchisement of people who had committed a felony has reared up in the campaign. With Bernie Sanders was on the CNN town hall a couple of days ago and was asked about whether people who were felons should be able to vote, and he went so far as to say, "I think someone should not lose their right to vote even if they're in prison." So, what do you think about that? It seems like an easier sell in terms of getting more support if you say, well, once you pay your dues and come out, you should have your voting rights restored. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, maybe it's not the best answer politically for Bernie Sanders, but I think it's the best answer morally. You know, why should we strip people, citizens, of the most valuable and fundamental aspect of citizenship because they've committed a crime? You know, we talk about the racist history of felon disenfranchisement. When we send someone to prison, we don't take away their citizenship. And in fact, they do retain some constitutional rights, not all, but even prisoners retain some constitutional rights. It seems to me that unless we're willing to say someone is no longer a citizen because of breaking the social contract and committing a crime, then we shouldn't also be taking away the most fundamental aspect of that citizenship.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it until I saw Bernie had that question. I went, oh, that's really interesting. And was it always so that we took that right to vote away? And you're saying, no, it wasn't. And actually what Bernie could have said was, in my state of Vermont, people are allowed to vote from prison.
Yeah, and again, democracy doesn't seem to be broken in either Vermont or Maine with this practice. And there are a bunch of other countries also that allow prisoners to vote from prison. So, you know, it's not all that of a radical practice. Now, I understand the politics of it, and perhaps going slower and having more incremental changes to the practice, you know, if people object to that, well, then hopefully they can at least agree that once you've paid all of your debt to society, you should become a productive member of society again and be allowed to vote. But still, I think if we're thinking about the morals of this, as well as the history of it, then there's a pretty good argument to never strip someone of their right to vote.
Right, that makes a lot of sense. And what do you think the social benefits are when people get the right to vote reinstored?
You know, I don't know exactly if there are studies yet about social benefits, so I can only speak to anecdotes. But I'll say people like Wes Powell really feel something important, feel special about their ability to participate again. I talk about some people in Virginia who received their certificates saying they had gained their right to vote back, and they framed the certificates that they received from the states. One woman broke down crying when she called her mother to say that she had regained her right to vote. Now, the other question is, you know, to what extent are there benefits for those still incarcerated to still be able to vote? And a colleague of mine and I are about to embark on a new project where we're going to look into that specifically with respect to prisoner voting. And is there, you know, some benefits to never having that right stripped away? But anecdotally, I mean, what's interesting is that many people who are returning citizens who have regained the right to vote have become some of the most reliable voters.
Right. I think that's great. Sometimes you don't know what you got till it's gone, and when something's taken away, you appreciate its value more. But we have a lot of people who have never lost the right to vote, but they don't bother to register or they don't bother to vote. What's the percentage of eligible voters who actually voted in our presidential election in 2016?
So in 2016, turnout was about 60%. In the 2018 midterms, turnout nationwide was about 50%, but that kind of misconstrues or hides the fact that some states had much higher turnout and some states had much lower turnout than 50%. The thing that struck me was that after 2018, people were almost celebrating this like great voter engagement because 50% was a record from decades in midterm turnout, and I thought to myself, why are we celebrating when half the eligible electorate didn't show up? That just didn't make sense to me.
Yeah. Well, when you say 50% of the people, eligible people, turned out, do you mean 50% of the registered voters turned out or 50% of the people who are citizens who are of age could vote if they had registered?
Correct. 50% of the eligible electorate, so not just of the registered voters.
Okay.
And when we start diving down into registered voters, well, states vary widely in terms of what the registration rules are. So some states, you have a requirement that you register 30 days before the election, or you can't vote. In other states, you can register on election day that have same-day registration. And what's interesting is that, you know, I noted that there's turnout differential in the 2018 midterm. Some states had much higher than others. The states with the highest turnout had same-day registration, which makes a lot of sense, right? Some people are not paying close enough attention until the weekend or day before the election, but that doesn't mean that they're not informed, engaged citizens, and that doesn't mean they should be cut out of the voting process. And so states like Minnesota and Wisconsin that have same-day registration see the highest turnout rates as well.
That's very interesting. Have you looked at other countries? Do you know how does the U.S. voter turnout compare to some other countries?
Generally speaking, pretty poor. And again, this depends somewhat on different laws in different countries. You know, Australia has mandatory voting, where it's essentially a requirement, or you have a small fine, a requirement just at least to show up to the polls. You can vote for none of the above. And they have turnout of over 90%, typically. France had an election a couple years ago where turnout was somewhere around 70%, and it was the lowest in decades. So 60% for our presidential election is, you know, really nothing to be proud of, in my view.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think part of why people don't, there's a lot of reasons why. One is it can be difficult to be, and as you're talking, the easier we make it, the more likely people are to turn out. If you have same date of voter registration, people are more likely to. And then there's the deeper issues of, does my vote matter? Are people thinking their vote doesn't matter? So let's talk a little bit about how do we make it easier to vote. And for example, in the state of Oregon, what are they doing to make it easier for voters to register?
Yeah, Oregon started what's known as automatic voter registration, where instead of having to opt in to the voter registration system, the state automatically puts everyone on the voter rolls using information the state already has through DMV offices, for example. You know, many people will go and update their driver's license, but not also think to update their voter registration information. And actually, the DMV is supposed to ask you if you want to register, but, you know, that doesn't always happen. So instead, Oregon said, let's just put everyone on the voter rolls. And this was started by a guy named Steve Trout, the elections director there, at least started statewide. There were some localities that had actually floated the idea, but Oregon was the first state to do it. And he was feeling heat from both the political left and the political right about both the ease of registering and also bloated voter registration rolls and outdated lists. And so he kind of went home one night and thought it over and said, you know, what can we do to make this more convenient and also save money and clean up the voter rolls all at the same time? And he said, well, why do we have to make people jump through hoops? We have the information already. Why can't we just put them on the rolls? So he went to the Secretary of State at the time, Kate Brown, who's now the governor, And she had also been thinking of something of a similar idea. She actually came up with a previous bill when she was in the legislature. And so they proposed this automatic voter registration bill. Then it took a lot of groundwork to have it pass. There was a group called the Oregon Bus Project, a youth advocacy group that was really instrumental in making sure the politics were there to actually pass this reform. And they did. And at the first election, when they used it, they registered over 100,000 new people who otherwise wouldn't have probably registered or voted, and turnout went up. And now this has spread to about 12 other states.
The automatic voter registration is in 12 other states now?
Yeah, it's about 12 and more coming on board. So it's been implemented in so-called blue states like Oregon and Washington, as well as so-called red states like Georgia and West Virginia. And election officials love it because it saves money and it saves time and it makes the voter rolls more accurate. And the voters love it because it's one less thing you have to do to become a valid voter. You're automatically put on the rolls. It just makes a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, let's make it easy and let's save money. What's not to love? And what's been the impact on voter turnout in the states that have the automatic voter registration? Do you know?
Generally, it's gone up. So, Oregon had tens of thousands of individuals vote who probably wouldn't have voted otherwise. And, same-day registration, as we mentioned, is probably the reform that has led to the largest increase for on the registration side, but automatic voter registration is a close second. And the states that have it have generally had higher turnout. Like I said, it's in about a dozen states now, and this is a great example of how one state can try something. It really works well, and so then other states hop on board. It's been implemented in about a dozen, with a handful more that are in the process of making it happen.
Yeah, and that's a great premise in your book. If people can make progress in a locality or a state and it does well, we can learn from that and bring it across the country. And that is, in fact, is what's happening. Now we've got thousands of citizens kind of stepping up and going, oh, well, we got a problem here. What can I do to help make it better? You write about a man named Scott Doyle, a Republican in Colorado, who was working to make it easier for people to vote. What did he do?
Yeah, this is a great story. Scott Doyle was an engineer by trade, had a long career as an engineer, and then decided at the end of his career to enter public service and joined the county clerk's office in Larimer County, Colorado. And he basically went there to kind of use his engineering expertise to help the office run more smoothly. And on Election Day 2000, he heard about something that really upset him. Some voters there were turned away from the polls. They'd gone to what they thought was the correct precinct towards the end of Election Day and were turned away because they went to the wrong place. Then they drove to what they thought was their correct polling place, or what turned out to be the correct polling place, and they were turned away there because the polling hours had closed. They ended up going to the county courthouse to see if maybe they could get some sort of ability to vote, and that didn't happen either. And so they were essentially disenfranchised because they had shown up at the wrong place during the right hours. So he went home one night, and he took out a pencil and a paper and his engineering expertise and started mapping out different models of voting. And he came up with a system known as vote centers. And a vote center model, instead of having to vote at your home-based precinct, a polling place closest to your home, you can vote anywhere in the county. They're all connected. All the vote centers are connected electronically so that if you check into one, you can't go vote in another place. And the ballot that's printed is the ballot for your home address, so you're voting on your local offices still. But imagine the convenience factor of not having to travel across town or carve out time far away, and go far away from work or from school. You can go to any vote center in the county, and the voters loved it. Turnout went up. Costs went down because the county had to have fewer polling places and fewer machines and fewer poll workers. And so this is really another win-win that, again, started by a Republican county clerk that then started to spread to other places in Colorado and then other places across the country.
That's great. And so that's the vote center, is it? That's where you would vote if you wanted to just show up somewhere in your county so you didn't get stuck into this particular locale or that, but just go to any vote center in your county. Is that it?
That's exactly right. And so it started in Larimer County, Colorado, and then moved to other places. And now I've just recently seen that both Houston, Texas is going to start using the vote center model, and the Kansas legislature has passed a law that will allow counties to opt in and move to vote centers, as well as a handful of places in Indiana. So this is really spread all over. And, you know, the notion that, as Doyle put it, is shouldn't voting be as easy as food shopping? You know, he said he can go to any supermarket that he encounters and basically find the same thing, no matter where he is, whether he's closer to home or to school or to work or whatever. Why is that not the same when it comes to voting? Why are we tied to our home-based precinct in this day and age? And we don't have to be. And he figured out a way to make that happen, and it really improves turnout and makes Election Day so much more convenient.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And then how do the different secretaries of state who are in charge of the elections figure out what's going on? Is there a systematic way that they find out kind of the best practices of what's working around the country, or is it kind of happenstance? Or how do these best practices get carried from one place to another across the country?
Yeah, well, there is a community of secretaries of states that that do talk to each other. There's a national organization of secretaries of states. But I think some of it also is ad hoc. And, you know, it's people telling their stories. You know, elected officials, election officials, those who run our elections, most of them really just want to do a good job. They don't care about partisanship. They just want to run the most convenient, most secure, most cost-effective elections, and they're really dedicated public servants. And so there is some discussion among them. I don't know that there's, besides the National Association, a hugely systematic way. And, you know, so hopefully my book can help spread some of these stories as well.
Yeah, hopefully. You got a lot of great stories in there. And another one in terms of making vote easier is voting by mail. Who started that, and what do you think of that?
Yeah, so universal vote by mail, where every registered voter receives a ballot in the mail automatically, is a, you know, really innovative reform. And, you know, maybe it doesn't sound innovative because we're still talking about paper ballots, which I think is a good thing for verification purposes and for recounts. This started in Oregon, which has been really an innovator for some of these ideas. It stemmed in part from a local election in Linn County, Oregon, where it was a local bond measure with only two voters that showed up. And the bond passed 2-0, so everyone knew how those two voters had voted. Whether you show up to the polls is an open record, although who you voted for is not. But if it's 2-0 and you know which voter showed up, you know how they voted. And the Secretary of State, or the county clerk, rather, there said, you know, this is crazy. Why am I spending this money to have an election with such low turnout? Is there a better way to do this? And San Diego actually had been using all vote by mail for one of its local elections. So she went down there and learned about the practice, and then, you know, got a bill passed in the Oregon legislature to allow her to run some vote by mail elections. And one of the people in the legislature at the time was a guy named Phil Kiesling, who voted no. He's a Democrat. He voted no. He didn't want to expand voting by mail. As he said, he sort of had this idealized notion of walking in the fall under the crunch of autumn leaves to your polling place. And then he became Secretary of State. And he had all these county clerks from around the country essentially begging for greater authorization for all universal vote by mail elections. And he changed his mind and recognized the convenience factor and the cost savings. And now Oregon has what they refer to as a vote at home. And this makes a lot of sense because everyone receives a ballot. You have a couple weeks before the election. You have time to sit at home and consider the issues, research the candidates, and then drop your ballot off at a secure mailbox, drop box, or mail it in. And now it's expanded to Washington, to Colorado, which has a dual system. Colorado has vote at home, or everyone receives a ballot, and then if you don't return it, you can go to a vote center on Election Day. And then other places like Utah, where all but one county in Utah uses vote at home as well.
Yeah, that's great. By the way, Phil Kiesling is a friend of mine. He was a classmate of mine at Yale, and he's a wonderful guy. Really, really like him a lot, and I'm glad he played a role in helping to make the voting easier with the vote by mail.
Yeah, he's so great, and he also started this national coalition called the National Vote at Home Coalition that's advocating for increased vote at home policies. As he says, this can really help save our democracy. And he tells a really great story. This as you know him, he kind of lives and breathes elections. And
right.
Yet he told me about how about a year ago he didn't know that there was an election for his home area for school board mm-hmm. until he received the ballot in the mail. And so then, he spent some time to research the candidates and voted in that election, when otherwise he probably wouldn't have because he didn't realize it was even going on. And he knows elections, which I think really drives home the convenience factor of this reform.
Right, exactly. Well, it's a nice reminder, if you get the ballot in the mail, time to fill it out and send it in. Now, a lot of these measures are great for making it easier for people who want to vote. I think we still have a problem of people who think that their vote doesn't matter because the level of influence of big money in politics and in the elections. But there's a move now afoot to have more public financing of elections, to kind of make it possible for more people to run. Tell us about Allison Smith, the stay-at-home mom in Maine, and what she did.
Eleanor, thanks for mentioning her, because she's just another great example of an everyday person who has really become a democracy champion. She moved to Portland, Maine from Connecticut and had been involved with the Connecticut League of Women Voters, basically on environmental issues. And when she moved, her friends in Connecticut bought her a membership to the Portland League of Women Voters. And when she arrived, someone called her and said, would you help gather signatures for a ballot measure to create a public financing system in Maine elections? And so she said, sure. Well, that turned into her becoming the precinct captain for her area to gather signatures to create public financing. And then that turned into her becoming really a public spokesperson for the measure. She would appear on television, which she said was sort of crazy because she didn't even own a TV at the time. And became really a face because she said the advocates understood that people wanted to hear from everyday Americans, not the talking heads in suits, but people who would really feel an effect of opening the system to everyone. And so that passed. And in fact, they've actually had a couple different ballot measures to reform it. And what it does is that anyone can opt in to receive public financing and refuse outside money or wealthy interests to fund their campaigns. And this really unshackles them from having to adhere to lobbyists. I talked to a legislator in Maine who said that there was a big consumer protection bill that came through and that a bunch of outside lobbyists were trying to influence the legislatures, but they all basically ignored them because they didn't have to rely on the lobbyist funding for their next campaign. And this allows restaurant workers or teachers or people who don't have any wealthy interests or ties to wealthy interests have a chance to run and win in Maine elections.
I love that. And I was just at the Unrig the System conference, which we had Josh Silver, who helped organize that, was on the show a couple of weeks ago. And I was so impressed. There were over 2,000 people there. And like you said, it's ordinary people doing extraordinary things to help reclaim our democracy. And one of the people there was on this theme of public financing, talked about the democracy dollars. So in the city of Seattle, people get like four vouchers worth $25 each. They each get $100 that they can use to donate to a candidate, and that's public money. And what they said is happening, several things happen then. People are more engaged because they feel like, oh, the candidate has to listen to me, the worker, not just be on the other side of town schmoozing with the rich people to get the big money donations. So you actually, as a candidate, your incentive would be show up at a union hall where there's lots of workers. You get lots of your $25 checks instead of a few big donors and a house party. So it shifted how candidates campaign. It also shifted who can run for office. So, more regular people said, oh, well, if we've got the public financing, I can run for office, and they're having a much more interesting selection, cross-class selection of who the candidates are. So this public financing can make a really positive contribution, don't you think?
I do, yeah, and I was actually at the UNRIG Summit as well, and what a great organization of activists who are, most of them are just everyday people who are fed up with our system and are trying to make a difference. With respect to the Seattle democracy vouchers, in that chapter, I talk about the origin of that as well. And it was really a guy named Alan Durning and a handful of other activists in Seattle who, in addition to some important organizations, who got the measure passed. And this is a really innovative system because instead of getting a lump sum, the amount of public money you receive depends on how many democracy vouchers you can collect. So you campaign for votes, but you also campaign for the vouchers, which, as you note, really makes you connect with the voters a lot more. And I just saw a study earlier this week, or a report that came out, that this year's use of democracy vouchers is up a ton in Seattle. And it's really driving out the outside money. Most campaign money in Seattle is staying within the city now, thanks to the democracy vouchers.
That's fantastic. Now, that's another innovation I'd love to see spread across to cities and states across the country. It's a wonderful one. And there was another, what you call, democracy champion at the Unrig the System conference, Katie Fahey of Michigan, who talked about putting up a post on her Facebook simply saying, "I want to end gerrymandering in Michigan. Will you help me?" And ended up getting hundreds of her fellow Michigan residents to help out, and they mobilized and passed a ballot measure to end gerrymandering. Tell us more about Katie Fahey.
Yeah, Katie's amazing, and it was a pleasure to get to speak with her some at the UNRIG Summit. As you noted, she was 27 years old when she posted on Facebook. She was working for the Michigan Recycling Coalition, and she did. She put up this post 2 days after the 2016 election that said, "I'm thinking of taking on redistricting in Michigan. Anyone want to help out?" Smiley face. She says the smiley face was an important part of the post. And she actually did it because she said she was kind of terrified of going to Thanksgiving dinner that year because her family is really politically split. She had no political experience, but, you know, she was interested in fixing our system, and she thought, what's the one thing that kind of everyone of all political persuasions can rally behind? And it's that politicians draw districts to help themselves. The politicians are picking the voters and not the other way around. And so she put this Facebook post up thinking that maybe a couple family members and friends would respond and they could all find an organization to go join. And a funny thing happened. Actually, not very many of her family members or friends responded, but a bunch of people started to share the post. First, it was about a dozen, and then a couple dozen, and then hundreds and thousands, and it started this whole new movement where they had to create a new organization called Voters Not Politicians. And they went all around the state to ask people, you know, what should go into redistricting? Who should draw the lines? What kind of independence should we require? And they drafted language for a ballot proposition. They gathered over 100,000 signatures in the span of 90 days using all volunteers. They didn't pay anyone, which was kind of unprecedented for something of that large scale. They got a ballot measure on the ballot for November 2018, and it passed overwhelmingly. And so now Michigan, during the next round of redistricting, which will start in 2021, will have an independent commission draw it as opposed to the self-interested politicians. And as Katie says, they essentially overthrew the government peacefully through this what started with a single Facebook post.
Yeah, it's truly amazing what a citizen who just starts taking action and asks for help to work together, the difference you can make. And absolutely every reform you're talking about, I believe, should have support across the spectrum, you know, left, right, Democrat, Republican, it doesn't matter. This is about really reclaiming and reforming and strengthening our democracy. And when you see the Unrig the System conferences, there were over 2,000 people there, all of them active in some way to help strengthen our democracy. And it truly is a movement, a democracy movement in the United States. And I had heard that phrase, but I thought, oh, no, it's, you know, it's really kind of fractured and, you know, small things here and there. But then when I saw them all together in the same place and heard the stories of these democracy champions you talk about, go, this is a democracy movement, don't you think?
Yeah, it's to me really powerful, and the most important part of it is that it's not being driven by the elected officials or in a top-down strategy. You know, Congress, you know, has this proposed bill, H.R. 1, the For the People Act, which has a lot of these ideas in it, and I think that's really important to recognize, is that the things that the congressional legislation has are already being implemented in various places, thanks to the advocacy of everyday individuals. And, you know, so if there's one message that I hope people take from the book, it's that this can happen from the ground up, and actually must happen from the ground up. That's historically how a lot of these voting rights movements began. And then eventually there's a tipping point. And I think this democracy movement, this grassroots, everyday American movement to make our elections easier, more convenient, a pro-voting rights initiative is gathering so much steam that we're going to get to a tipping point pretty soon, I hope.
Yeah, I hope so, too. And your book is a big step in the right direction, the Vote for Us book. And you also talk about, yes, we absolutely, everything starts with the individual and these democracy champions coming out of nowhere, 27-year-old Katie Fahey, we got the stay-at-home mom, Allison Smith in Maine. These ordinary Americans just taking it on themselves to make a difference, and wow, they're really making a huge difference. And in addition to that, it also is true that individuals need support to make the change, and either draw on existing organizations or create an organization to help them do, as Katie Fahey did in Michigan for getting rid of gerrymandering. What are some of the organizations that stand out to you as giving support to this grassroots movement that's happening?
You know, Eleanor, I think it varies based on the state. And mm-hmm. So that's one reason that I included an appendix in the back of the book that has a listing of all 50 states and organizations in each one that are working on these issues. So no matter where someone is, they can flip to the back and find an organization to contact. You know, there's my fear in writing the book was that people would say, okay, I'm inspired, which I hope they are. I have hope that the system can change. There's not all doom and gloom out there. But now what, right? And right. So many people in this political environment, I think, you know, complain about the system being, you know, again, using that word rigged, but don't know what to do about it. Mm-hmm. And so my goal in writing the appendix was to provide some direction. So no matter what state you're in, you can find one of these groups. And then the second half of the appendix has national organizations. So if you're really interested in campaign finance or redistricting or representation of minority groups, you can find an organization in the back that are doing really, that's doing really great work.
Yeah, and it's such a great roster of organizations that you've got there. I think it's worth buying your book, Vote for Us, just to see the organizations that are there and to know what they are, where they are, who's in your state that you can connect to. It's a great directory of the organizations that are kind of the backbone to this democracy movement happening. And by the way, I notice you have a plug for your book from my good friend Francis Moore LePay, who's also been on this show. And in fact, I was just speaking with her yesterday. As you may know, Frankie is putting together a website that hopefully will be like a one-stop shop for the democracy movement, so people can go on the web and click on, you know, I'm in this state, what's happening there. So that'll be a wonderful thing when that gets up and running. I want to go back to these democracy champions, and particularly in the state of Maine, which was right there and working for the public financing. Maine is also in the forefront of the ranked choice voting. And I know we need a new name for this, but can you explain to our listeners what exactly is ranked choice voting and why it's a good idea and where it's happening?
Yeah, absolutely. So in a ranked choice voting system, instead of having to choose one candidate among many, like most of us do in our elections, you can rank order your preferences. You can say, I like this candidate first, that person second, that person third. And this opens up the opportunity for providing more choices and for making people feel like their vote actually will make a difference. I think it really can reduce voter apathy. So how does it work on the back end in terms of the counting? Well, after everyone is ranked to their ballot, the election officials see, did anyone receive 50% of the first place votes? 50%
Wait a minute now. Just walk me through. I'm a voter. I go into the I go into the voting center to vote, and I write, so to say, four candidates for an office. I don't just say, oh, I'm going to vote for Josh. I say, I'm going to vote number one for Josh, number two for Frankie, number three for the other one. So I actually designate them each by a certain, the way I want to rank them in terms of who I really want to win. Is that right?
Absolutely correct. And you don't have to rank all four candidates, right? If you think one of them would be terrible, you can just rank your top three choices. But yes, you would literally write, you know, or you'd either write the number one, or you'd fill in the bubble for first choice for that candidate, second choice for a different candidate, and actually have in the book, I have a copy of a sample ballot from Maine that shows exactly what this looks like.
What if I wanted just, I thought Josh Douglas is the only one I want in there. Could I vote for you one, two, three, and four?
No, you just vote for me as first choice.
Just for one. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So
yeah.
Go ahead.
You choose each candidate once.
Yeah.
And you put which place, you know, first choice, second choice, third choice, for as many or as few candidates as you want.
Great. And then how do the vote tally people know who won?
So first they see, did any candidate receive 50% plus one of the votes? Because if a majority chose a candidate as their first choice, that person is clearly the winner. Assuming that's not the case, here's what they do. They look to see who came in last of the first place votes. And that candidate is eliminated, and that the people who voted for that candidate have their second choice count instead. So imagine it this way. The election officials make piles. Let's say there's four candidates. They'll make four piles for everyone who voted first place for that candidate. And they'll see which has the smallest pile, which candidate has the smallest pile of first place votes. And they'll take the ballots from that pile and they'll reallocate them among the other candidates based on who is listed second on each ballot. And they'll do that process again until one of the piles has 50% of the votes. So the goal here is to get an overall consensus of the electorate where the winner always will have 50% of the votes. It may not be 50% of the first choice votes, but at some point on the ballot, the winner has had a majority vote of preferences of the electorate.
Well, what I like about this system is that then you make sure that someone who does win is someone who's got a majority support among the people, and it may not have been evident on the first tally, but by the time you pick a winner, it's someone who's got at least 50% plus one. So that's good, and I can understand why Maine was one of the first places to put this in. Maybe it is the first, because they had that crazy guy run for governor, but since it was a three-way race, he ended up winning with a plurality. He never got 50% of the vote, but he won.
Not even close.
Like,
he got,
yeah,
I
like
think, the first time he won 36%, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. And he did it not once, but twice, and people were embarrassed. He was so awful as a governor. They couldn't wait to get him out, but then it happened again. So now with that will not happen. So you'd have, with the ranked choice voting system, someone like that who might get 36% support in the first round that's the ceiling. I mean, that may be the most he's ever going to get.
Yeah, and so, you know, this system was used decades ago in places like Cincinnati, but it fell out of use largely because voting machines couldn't handle it, 70, 80 years ago. And the more modern history of it started in San Francisco, which used ranked choice voting for the first time in the early 2000s. It was passed, again, thanks to local advocacy, a guy named Stephen Hill, was one of the main people behind it. And he would go to bars at night and gather the attention of the crowd and say, let's all rank our favorite beers to demonstrate how the system was pretty understandable and easy to use. And then eventually got passed in San Francisco. It's moved now to places like Minneapolis and St. Paul, Minnesota. Portland, Maine used it before it went statewide. And this is a great example of, again, this movement where something happens on the local level, thanks to democracy champions, and then expands. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis once said that states are laboratories of democracy, that one innovative state can try something new, and then if it works, it'll spread to other places. And I like to say that if states are laboratories of democracy, then cities and towns can be test tubes of democracy, trying something out on an even smaller scale, and once it works, it'll start to spread and eventually even statewide. And so Maine passed it statewide thanks to two different ballot initiatives that had to pass, and now it's been implemented and it was used in 2018 very successfully.
Yeah, and it's being used in some countries. I understand the whole country of Ireland uses it. So, and is it true that this is the process of voting that we use to select winners in the Academy Awards?
It is, at least for the Best Picture. When the Academy expanded the nominees from 5 to 10 a handful of years ago, they also decided to do ranked choice voting to decide the Best Picture winner. And that's because they were afraid with 10 films that the Academy's voters could, you know, choose a best winner that would only have 20% support among the Academy. So now many people have said that they're unhappy with this year's best winner, and maybe that's an argument against ranked choice voting. My view is actually that the system still worked. I didn't see the movie, but I think the system worked because the movie that won did have a support among a majority. It may not have been first choice, but it was a consensus pick of at least a majority in, you know, second or third choices to beat out all the other films. Let me say one more thing about the benefits of ranked choice voting. This can really make our elections more positive. Our elections are so negative right now. Negative campaigning works, unfortunately. But in a ranked choice voting system, you're less likely to go negative against your opponent. And here's why. If, I'm running against, you know, Frankie, let's say, as the primary other person, I'm not going to want to throw mud at her because I don't want to alienate her supporters. Because I want, if I can't get their first choice vote, I at least want their second choice vote. And so I'm much more likely to explain the differences between us in a positive way and hope I can get their first choice votes, but if not, get their second choice, because that might make a difference in the end. And the places that have adopted ranked choice voting have seen this, have demonstrated that the campaigning is so much more positive thanks to this reform.
I love that, and I think it's a great system. I hope it spreads rapidly everywhere, and I will give a beer or a glass of wine to whoever comes up with a better name than ranked choice voting.
Yeah, the other name that people use for it is instant runoff voting, or IRV. I'm not sure that's any better, but it's descriptive, at least, in terms of the back-end counting.
Right, exactly. So let's talk a little bit about the Electoral College. That's become an issue, actually, in the current presidential campaign, which I'm surprised about. Are you in favor of abolishing the Electoral College, and if so, why?
I am in favor of it. I think the Electoral College, if it had a good purpose back at our founding, it's outlived its purpose, and that we should go to a national popular vote plan. And this is because we have national campaigns. When the Electoral College was created by the founders, we didn't have national campaigns like that. It was difficult to even travel around. And we had this real concern. I mean, and part of it goes to this protection of the southern states and their desire to protect slavery as well, in terms of the history of it. But I just think, you know, our elections are national now, so shouldn't they reflect the national consensus? Now, I spend only a couple pages in the book about the Electoral College because, again, the book is really focused on things that are already working and already being implemented in some places so that another locality and another individual can say, you know, oh, it's working there, and so I can see how I can help to make a difference as well. There is a plan for abolishing the Electoral College, kind of a workaround called the National or Popular Vote Interstate Compact, and we can talk about that if you'd like. But, you know, that's a broader change that I think is time is needed, but we aren't there yet, just yet.
Yeah, well, we have just a minute or two left here, and I'm wondering for our listeners, you know, you've now got this incredible treasure trove of what is working around strengthening our democracy in your book, Vote for Us. Can you just mention a couple of things for our listeners if they want to help out and get into this democracy movement? What are a couple of things you suggest our listeners could do?
I think it's little things like, you know, learn about these ideas and talk to your neighbors. You know, if you're interested in ranked choice voting and you're part of a local group, get it implemented to elect the officers of your group, to get people to understand how it really works. Write op-eds for your local newspapers. You know, we didn't talk about the importance of local journalism, but I have a whole chapter on that because I think it's so important. Get involved with the local schools to improve civics education, another aspect that is really important to the democracy movement. These are local things that, you know, you can do. Little things breed bigger changes, and I think that's really important and hopefully one of the messages from the book.
Absolutely, and it's a fantastic book. I encourage all our listeners to get it. Just came out. It's called Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. So hope all our listeners go read it and spread the word. That's all the time we have. The book is Vote for Us, and thank you, Joshua A. Douglas. Thank you so much for being with us today and all your great work for democracy.
Thanks, Eleanor. This was fun.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available as podcasts. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor Lacaine with All Together Now.